The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on this week's show, we speak to theoretical physicist Steven Weinberg, Nobel laureate and one of the world's most respected scientists. His new book conveys just how hard scientific understanding has been for us to arrive at as a civilization, and why modern science should retain a sense of history to avoid repeating past mistakes. How did the prevailing cultural norms impede the potential for scientific innovation of our forefathers? And what does it take to arrive at a really good scientific theory? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Professor Steven Weinberg describes his life's quest as a desire to create a universal textbook, a single volume explaining the laws of nature in a few basic principles. His childhood experiments with a chemistry set compelled him to understand more about why atoms work the way they do. His new book, To Explain the World, is more than just a chronology of scientific breakthroughs. It shows us how we learn to learn about the world. I spoke to Steven Weinberg last week, and I began by asking him, why do we need another book about the history of science?
Well, there was a need for me to write the book. I have been writing about history as part of my writing about physics for years, because I think it's important for physicists to get the historical background of what they're doing. But it's been recent history, and I've become more and more puzzled by what our forebears were really like. These days, although we sometimes disagree about scientific matters, there's a general sense of agreement about what it takes to make a good scientific theory, how we test it, how we confirm it or refute it, how we come upon it in the first place. When you go back into the past, you find that the natural philosophers, they didn't call themselves scientists, of the past had very different ideas. Plato criticized Anaxagoras because he tried to explain the behavior of the planets as they move in the sky in an impersonal, naturalistic way, rather than explaining why it was necessary that they had to behave that way, why it was better that they behave that way than in some other way. That kind of demand for purpose in our understanding of nature has gone away. It's just one example of how different the thinkers of the past were. And I felt I had to understand that. I hope in trying to understand it myself, I've written something that will help readers to understand how hard it's all been, how far from obvious in the past were what we take as the standards of scientific knowledge. I don't think that much of what I say will be a surprise to professional historians, but if I had read this book a few years ago, it would have been a surprise to me.
The book is not just about how we learned about the world, as you put it, but how we learn to learn about the world. Again, your line, and I wonder whether...
Yeah, we learned how to learn about the world, and also, perhaps even more significant, how we came to learn what there is to learn about the world. There are things that we've learned not to try to explain. For example, both Ptolemy in the Roman period and Kepler during the scientific revolution tried to explain why the planets are the distance that they are from the central body. For Ptolemy, the central body was the Earth. For Kepler, it was the Sun. In both cases, they tried to explain the arrangement of what we now call the solar system. Well, we know that that's a historical accident. We know that we're never going to be able to explain why the Earth is 93 million miles from the Sun. It's something that happened long ago. It's lost. We can't ever recover we can explain this sort of thing statistically. We can explain perhaps why the smaller rocky planets are closer to the sun than the big gas giants, but we'll never explain the details. That's terribly important. It was a criticism of Newton, Newton's theory of the solar system, that he hadn't succeeded in explaining why the planets are where they are. Well, we've learned that's not something we're going to explain. Learning what there is to learn, what there is to understand, what there is to explain, is perhaps the most important element in the scientific progress of the past.
Was that also the most difficult bit, though, this body of work where you're actually trying to get to grips with how to even start trying to learn about the world?
Yes, none of it is obvious. It's all very difficult. We often don't know when we've made progress and when we haven't. But there comes a time when you've explained so much, when things have worked out so well in comparison with observation, when you've predicted new things which also agreed with observation, that you feel a sense of joy. The scientist does, perhaps the public learning about this does. And it's these moments of utter happiness that provide the driving force. But we don't know in advance where we're going to find them. We don't know in advance the shape they're going to take. I wanted in this book to make clear to the reader, first of all to myself and then to the reader, just what a muddle it's all been, how far removed it is from any preconceived progress.
Are there any examples you can give us about how people did really crack this idea of how to learn about the world, about, you know, or were they all just muddling through and it only becoming apparent much later when their results could be checked and verified and reproduced and so on, that people started honing down really what was meant by meaningful scientific method and so on?
I don't think there ever was a time when the progress of science was materially aided by anyone, scientist or philosopher or anyone else, laying down rules for scientific progress. The most well-known examples of that sort of rule-making are, at the time of the Scientific Revolution, Francis Bacon, who decreed that we should just observe nature in an unprejudiced way and gather facts until we have a useful body of knowledge, and René Descartes, a much more subtle and effective scientist, who attempted to describe rules for rightly conducting the reason, and those rules didn't prevent him from making, half a dozen outrageous scientific errors. It doesn't work to set rules in advance. You learn how to do science the way you learn to ride a bicycle, by doing it. But then, after it's been done, you then sometimes look back and say, oh, yes, that's the way to go. And the great example of that, I think, is Isaac Newton. By describing fundamental mathematical principles that governed all matter everywhere in the universe, and then applying it to the planets and the Earth and the Sun and the Moon, and seeing that his rules agreed with what is observed to an extent that could not have been imagined earlier, he set an example for the way that science should be. And it's the Newtonian example that we've been following ever since. It's not Newton himself. Newton, as John Maynard Keynes emphasized, was not entirely a modern scientist. And you see this in the enormous amount of effort he put into his study of religion or biblical chronology. He saw some things as inexplicable without divine intervention, like the fact that the sun is bright and the planets are dark, which today we understand perfectly well in a purely naturalistic way. So he wasn't always right, and he didn't always think in the right way. But what he did accomplish was so stunning that we've all been imitating him ever since.
What were the kind of factors that knocked these early scientists off course? Were they, I presume, the idea of understanding being tied in with religion, with other cultural aspects and sort of norms of thinking must have clouded people's thinking. But I'm interested in what the factors are, apart from presumably, hopefully, the main one, that understanding nature is just hard.
It is hard, and it doesn't get easier, although it does get more effective. I try to outline, especially in the chapters on Greek physics, how one of the great difficulties was sorting out the relation of science to intellectual neighbors, to other modes of thinking, which may or may not be valuable in themselves, which seem to overlap with science, but in a confusing way that had to be sorted out. One of them is mathematics. Today we take it almost for granted that fundamental principles of at least physical science are to be expressed mathematically. As Galileo said in the Essayer, no one can understand the laws of nature without understanding the language in which those laws are written, and that language is the language of mathematics. We now, since Galileo, have taken that pretty much in stride. But in the early days, during the Hellenic period, for example, it appeared to some, like Plato, that science was just a branch of mathematics, that you could proceed, for example, in understanding the heavens the way you proceed in understanding triangles and squares by thinking about them. And Plato thought you might be assisted by looking at the sky the same way that someone learning geometry is assisted by looking at geometrical diagrams. But in both cases, the truth is accessible by pure thought. Well, we know that's not true. Science isn't a branch of mathematics. In the end, it rests on observation and experiment. The truths we learn in that way are mathematical, but we couldn't have learned them just by studying mathematics. We're often inspired by mathematics to do physics, and that's sort of spooky, that mathematics that's done for no reason having to do with the natural world turns out to be useful in understanding the natural world. We don't quite know why that's true, although I have ideas, but it was much more confusing to the Hellenic Greeks. Another intellectual neighbor of science is aesthetics. Scientific theories are sometimes inspired by feelings of beauty and harmony. Sometimes they turn out to be correct, sometimes they turn out to be wrong. For the earliest Greeks, there was no idea at all of checking whether their theories were right or wrong. When Thales said that everything is water and Democritus said everything is atoms, they didn't attempt to justify that in terms of observation of the real world. They were behaving much more like poets, being motivated purely by aesthetic considerations, by a vision of what a wonderful world might be, rather than by the give and take between that kind of aesthetics and down-to-earth observation of the world. And, of course, as your question indicated, there's always been the muddle between science and religion. Over the centuries, religion has, in most enlightened parts of the world, retreated from its presumption of saying something about the natural world. The Catholic Church has recognized not only that Galileo was right about the earth moving around the sun, and the church at that time was wrong in condemning him, but that it's not the business of religious authority to set controls on scientific theories. As Galileo quoted a religious authority of his own time, Holy Scripture is not there to tell us how the heavens go, but to how to go to heaven. Well, I'm not sure it does that either, but you see the point. But there is a deeper tension between science and religion, which has always been there and which survives to the present, and that is the question of whether the scientific worldview, by accounting for the natural world as it does, insofar as it does, has left room for religion, or whether it is, to some extent, a distraction from religion. St. Paul, at the beginning of Christianity, and Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, at the end of the golden age of Arab science, both argued that religion was a distraction from the things that really ought to concern us, the things of the spirit. And in fact, al-Ghazali acknowledged that studying mathematics and astronomy would strengthen the mind as wine strengthens the body, but he said nevertheless that they are distractions which we should put aside as we put wine aside within the Islamic tradition. This continues. It is a rather dismal prospect to suppose that human beings came into the world through millions of years of random breeding and eating, that we are not here to fulfill some divine purpose, that there is nothing for us after we die, that we will not again see the ones we love. It's very saddening, and so religion inescapably has a tremendous attraction. I never have claimed that science can fill the gap left by religion, but nevertheless, my conclusion is that it's worth pursuing and that we can take a kind of grim satisfaction from looking at the world with the eyes of science as an impersonal, cold world in which we don't play a starring role, and not flinch from that prospect.
It's not too comforting, is it, Stephen?
Maybe we shouldn't expect comfort. I've given up missionary work. I mean, if people don't feel this way and prefer to continue in their religious traditions, I don't feel it's my task to disabuse them.
Sure. I wanted to come back to this idea of things that have knocked people off course in the past, and presumably these sort of teleological ideas where you give inanimate objects purpose was one of these issues. And I don't know whether that itself came out of a sort of religious thinking that an object would fall because its purpose was to be, or it had some kind of need to be closer to the center of the earth than not. But you know, these, I don't know where these strange ideas came from, which clearly pushed people in the wrong direction.
Well, what you've just described as the idea that objects have a natural place, if they're made of heavy elements like earth and water, it's toward the center of the world. And if they're made of air and fire, to that extent, it's away from the center, toward the heavens. That idea is due to Aristotle. Aristotle did not defend it on religious grounds, and there's very little religion in Aristotle, in contrast to Plato. It was really a brilliant idea because it came very close to our understanding of gravity. For example, Aristotle knew perfectly well that if you travel south, the appearance of the sky seems to change, indicating that the earth is not flat, but is a sphere. And at the same time, he understood that travelers won't fall off when they get to the other side of the earth, because there isn't any universal down direction. Rather, the travelers, wherever they are on the earth, are attracted toward the center. For them, down is always toward the center of the world. He explained that's why the earth is a sphere, because that allows the greatest amount of matter to get close to the center of the world, and the center of the earth therefore coincides with the center of the world, that is, the universe. He never bothered to explain something he knew, that the moon is also a sphere, even though it is not a sphere whose center is the center of the world, which is the center of the earth. But he was pretty close to the idea of gravity, but it had nothing to do with religion. It did have to do with his idea of the natural rather than the artificial. Everything has a natural place for earth and water. It's down for fire and air. It's up. And things tend to go to their natural place. He saw that as their purpose, not a purpose in a human sense, that they're doing it for our benefit, but the purpose of fulfilling their nature. But, you know, Aristotle is really just before the beginning of real science. His lack of interest in applying mathematics to the natural world meant that he was incapable of making the sort of progress that was made just a generation later, when the center of Greek science moved from Athens to Alexandria after the death of Alexander the Great. Aristotle is an interesting figure because he covered so much in a naturalistic way, and he argued, unlike Plato or Democritus or Thales or any of the other pre-Socratics, he tried to justify his statements about the world, often relying not only on logic, but also on observation. He's a very impressive figure, but he still is not a scientist in the sense that the great scientists of the Hellenistic age, Hero and Ptolemy and Aristarchus and Hipparchus were. It's the lack of understanding of the importance of mathematics that held him back.
You make a point in the book about saying that historians are often a bit wary about judging the past by the standards of today, and you don't choose that route yourself. You've talked about some of the kind of errors you've uncovered, or some of the dubious things you've uncovered in how people did science. But I wondered if people stand out by today's standards as making really dramatic and impressive leaps in understanding, given what they had to go on and given the state of knowledge around them.
I think the construction of a mathematical model of the solar system in the Hellenistic and Roman era by Greek astronomers is one of the great monuments of scientific understanding. Hipparchus and Apollonius developed a picture of the planets moving on looping orbits, on epicycles. They moved on circles whose centers moved on larger circles all around the Earth, which actually mathematically gives precisely the same description of the way planets move apparently in the sky as the modern theory based on the work of Copernicus, that the planets, including the Earth, go around the Sun. In fact, in one version, Ptolemy's theory is identical to the simplest version of the theory of Copernicus, except from the question of the point of view. Do you imagine the solar system from the point of view of a stationary Earth or a stationary Sun? But as far as the relative motions, in one version of the simplest picture of Ptolemy is the same as the simplest picture of Copernicus. It was a tremendous achievement, which lasted for millennia until the scientific revolution. We know from some lines of Ptolemy's personal reflections, which I quote in the book, that it gave him the sort of joy to have done this that I think provides the driving force behind scientific progress. That was a enormous achievement. Of course, it was dwarfed by the achievement of Newton, who not only, as Kepler had done more accurately than Ptolemy, described the solar system, but explained it in terms of a force, a universal force between particles of matter, extending to great distances and decreasing as the inverse square of the distance. But there were other things in the Hellenistic period that are also tremendously impressive, like Archimedes' work on floating bodies, in which in a perfectly rational way he explained why it has to be that a floating body displaces an amount of water whose weight is equal to its own, and a body submerged in water will appear to weigh less if you suspend it from a balance. It will appear to weigh less in the water than it does in the air by an amount equal to the weight of the water it displaces. These are really very impressive achievements. Those people were very smart. Archimedes in particular, because of his mathematical brilliance, learning how to calculate the area of a circle or the volume of a sphere before the advent of modern calculus, that's pretty impressive.
You're bringing all my afternoon science practicals back to me by going through all of those, Stephen. I just wondered if, looking at all the scientists you cover, how do you think scientists today will be viewed, or the state of science today will be viewed, looking back in the future? I mean, do you think people will be, those people from the future will be looking back and saying, you know what, these scientists of the early 21st century were so way off and they had no idea?
Well, that is not the worst I can imagine. The worst I can imagine is that a few centuries in the future, historians will look back and say, they reached a certain level of achievement in the 20th and 21st century, which we haven't been able to surpass because we've run out of money. We haven't built any more observatories in space or large accelerators. We're just stuck with the data that they were able to assemble, and we're not smart enough to go beyond that just using pure thought. The worst I imagine, which is not unimaginable, is that scientific progress will stop because the human race stops devoting resources to it. I think if resources continue to be put into science, it will continue to progress. We certainly see brilliant young people coming into the sciences, many of them with a depth of mathematical knowledge that my generation of physicists never had. So there's plenty of talent to make progress. And if we go on acquiring data, I think progress will be made. And I hope that they will look back at us and say, well, they were very clever developing quantum mechanics, but we now know better. We have a better theory which avoids all those terrible problems they got into when trying to understand quantum mechanics. Or, yeah, it was very clever of them in the 20th and 21st century to learn that the universe is expanding and it started with a period of inflation. But now we really know what was going on and why things are the way they are. I hope that they will look back at us the way we look back at the Hellenistic scientists, giving them due credit for what they were able to get done, but perhaps a little condescendingly explaining how far they were from real understanding. But that's not to say that what we have learned will be abandoned. The progress of science has been not that we abandoned previous successful theories, but we learn how they work as an approximation to a more correct theory when they do work. We now understand, for example, electricity and magnetism in a way that's very different from the way James Clerk Maxwell understood it. But we still use Maxwell's equations. The equations survive, even though many of Maxwell's ideas have not, because we now understand that those equations represent an approximation to a more nearly exact theory, quantum electrodynamics, which we worked out in the 20th century. In the future, our standard model of elementary particles, which I did contribute to, will be seen as just an approximation to a more rational, aesthetically appealing, and accurate theory.
Steven Weinberg's new book, To Explain the World, is published by Alan Lane. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Steven Weinberg. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.